Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable on the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. We have a wonderful panel before us for the program today and a lot of very weighty, cool topics to talk about. Let me introduce our panel. WAMC's Alan Chartok is in his rightful corner. Good morning, Alan.
Hello.
WAMC News Director Ian Pickus is with us as well.
Good morning. Good morning, guys.
Good morning, Ian. And Times Union Capital reporter Jimmy Vielkind is here. Good morning, Jimmy. How are you?
Always a good morning and a kind of a busy morning.
You know, it is absolutely a busy morning, and we're thrilled that you can be with us. It's been a little while since we've talked to you because you've been in this this budget
purgatory is
dome.
The word.
Is that the is purgatory?
It's a purgatory. Yeah.
It's been between you, Liz Benjamin, and Karen DeWitt. We've tried to have you all come in and talk, and I would get emails at like 3 a.m. that would say, "Okay, this whole thing, I can't schedule my life around this." And so here you are. We're finally done, and as the dust is starting to settle in this process.
Yesterday was a glorious quiet day, and then this morning,
boom.
Boom.
So let's talk about the boom, and then we'll talk about the budget and sort of do a recap. The boom is Malcolm Smith and Dan Halloran arrested for trying to rig the New York City mayoral election, according to a report. And I guess it's safe to say we don't know a lot yet. More will emerge this morning. But what we know of now, as of now, is what?
We know Malcolm Smith, a Queens Democrat, represents kind of the southeast portion of that borough, is under arrest. He was arrested this morning by FBI agents at his home, along with, as you said, Dan Halloran, a Republican member of the New York City Council, Jay Savino, the chairman of the Bronx GOP, Vince Tibone, the vice chairman of the Queens GOP, and a few other officials from upstate in Rockland County. And again, it's hard to know exactly what's going on. The FBI has scheduled a press conference for 11 a.m. this morning in Manhattan, and we expect that there will be court papers that become public at some point this morning. Unfortunately, I can't read them. I'm here in the studio with you. But according to a report in Alan's favorite newspaper, the New York Post.
P-O-S-T.
I do know how to spell it. according to the report this morning, essentially, Mr. Smith, who is a Democrat and had flirted with running for the New York City mayoralty as a Republican, is alleged to have tried to bribe his way onto that line. Now, you know, being a Republican county chairman in New York City is probably not on the list of most glorious jobs in the world. New York City is a very Democratic place, but, you know, every 4 years these mayoral elections come along and people have realized that the Republicans have a party line and not necessarily a very deep bench. And so people think that maybe they can find themselves in a position to be the Republican candidate by offering beneficences to these Republican county leaders. Michael Bloomberg, the current mayor, for example, was able to win the Republican line and just coincidentally happened to donate a lot of money to these various little county party organizations.
Allowed. That's allowed.
That's allowed.
That's allowed.
Now, we don't know the facts of the allegations against it,
like,
but it seems that
beneficences.
Yeah,
like that.
But we don't know the essential fact pattern about what Smith and Halloran as a go-between and these chairmen are accused of doing, but it seems to be some variation on that, which you would think tended more toward personal enrichment than, as you said, Alan, an allowed contribution to a campaign committee.
So to get the support and to get on the ballot without changing affiliation, he needed the support of three boroughs. Am I right on that?
That's correct. He needed something called a Wilson-Pakula declaration.
So this is Queens, St. Albans, and Jamaica.
That's right. So the southeast portions, this is around Kennedy Airport, predominantly African-American neighborhoods, you know, a lot of homes, more definitely middle-class neighborhoods. And Smith has been in office since the 1990s, I believe, since the late 90s. He, of course, succeeded David Patterson as the Democratic leader in the state Senate after Patterson became lieutenant governor in 2006-2007 under the election of Elliot Spitzer. Smith served in that post as Democratic leader in the Senate for most of the beginning of 2009 and was essentially forced out after the June 2009 Senate coup in which two Democrats defected to join the Republicans, giving them control of the chamber, causing a month-long stalemate and, basically a month of craziness before the Democrats re-embraced those two defecting Democrats, Senators Hiram Monserrat and Pedro Espada, both of whom have been convicted of federal crimes, I believe, unrelated to that exact coup.
All the kids are doing it,
you know,
these
days. It's just a thing. But they re-embraced them, and in the course of doing that, one of the conditions for Monserrat and Espada to come back into the Democratic fold was that Smith was going to be kind of booted from the seat of power, even though he did hold on to a title for a long time.
You know, if you're going to rig an election, Smith is kind of a boring name. Blagojevich, much more fun to say, but still. Alan, what do you make of this?
Well, I first of all, I'm fascinated by it. But I have to tell you, Plunkett of Tammany Hall, my favorite book of all times, little thing, if anybody wants to read it, you can read it real fast, and he said something like, I can't do the exact words, there's legal graft and there's illegal graft.
Honest graft.
Yeah, honest graft. And dishonest graft. Well, I've always told my students, look, if you can get away with certain things, but if you say something into a microphone that is illegal, you're done. And I have a feeling the FBI doesn't come knocking on your door and pull you out in your pajamas unless they have something pretty solid.
Yeah, 6 a.m.
And also,
I find that interesting.
Also, what's a secret? In other words, what's a secret? A secret is something that you tell one other person. You tell 6 other people a secret, and you can pretty well figure that there's an exponential, geometric, arithmetic.
Somebody's going to be a snake.
Well, no, you're going to figure that within 3 hours, 700 people will know your secret. So that if this thing is really as extensive as Jimmy says, or is telling us, that is going to mean that somebody was very stupid because there were too many people in on the secret.
Well, let's just zoom out for a moment, and I'll ask a very naive political question. And I sort of, you know, obviously I understand, but I'm interested because you keep seeing, keep hearing these things, and you wonder, well, how do they not think they're going to get caught?
Well, you know, Al and I were actually talking about this just before the show started, so I often ponder this on whenever a public figure gets arrested for public corruption or for some other charge, and the best explanation that I have heard from various people is that, you know, there's something in your psyche where if you are the person in the room who says, me, vote for me, select me, bring me forward, I will represent you, me, and the same type of person who brings themselves to that forefront. And has that mental part of their brain that lets them do that, because there are a lot of shy people in this world, right?
Yeah.
That same quality in their mind also says, well, it gives them a self-image of, well, you know, I can bend this law.
Is this called arrogance?
Or this isn't such a big thing.
Is this called arrogance?
Yeah, I think that there's an element of arrogance to it. I think that there's an element of self-denial to it. I think that there is an element of intimacy with the system and knowing, you know, what's the speed limit? Is it 65 or is it 74?
Two.
You know, right? So 72. So I think
it's what you can get away with and what you can't get away with. What they'll look the other way on. What they won't look the other way on.
And it's not only Democrats. You know,
oh,
you see Republicans do this all the time.
Not.
Yeah. Speaking of which, can a Republican win a New York City mayoral election in
2014?
I don't believe we've had a Democrat since David Dinkins.
Mm-hmm. Right, Giuliani.
Mm-hmm. Giuliani,
Bloomberg for three.
By Bloomberg for 3 terms. Bloomberg started as a Republican, then he became, he started as a Democrat, became a Republican, and now he's an independent.
But so the larger question is, did Malcolm Smith, quote-unquote, blow, assuming this damages his political future, which maybe it will, a chance to actually win a race that has been blown wide open by the absence of, you know, Representative Wiener and Quinn's own issues.
Yeah. Well, I think that the whole idea of Malcolm Smith for mayor gained some simmering traction last year. I think that the first reports happened over the summer and then into the autumn and into the fall. There was a complete vacuum. The GOP did not have candidates that were strong that had stepped forward, and Malcolm, who is an African American man, and figured he might have an appeal to a racial appeal to a lot of people, who had a track record in elective of office, who is, of course, an enrolled Democrat and has, you know, long-standing enrollment as a Democrat, felt that he might be a person who could be attractive in a city where, you know, there aren't very many enrolled Republicans.
But he needed that Wilson Pakula.
But he needed the acquiescence of Republican officials to get on their party line. I think, though, that in the months since then, there hasn't been much talk about Smith as a mayoral candidate. Joe Loda, the chairman of the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, who stepped down to explore a bid and has launched a bid. He's a former aide to former New York City Mayor Giuliani. He seems to be one of the major Republican candidates. John Katsimatidis, the billionaire founder of Gristidis Supermarkets in New York City.
That's a good name. Yeah.
And that's a great name, as Joe points out.
Got to get him in some graft.
Yeah, that's good.
His money and the fact that he has a long history in New York politics as a donor, as a bundler, as a person, that has given him some gravitas. And then there are other people like George McDonald, the founder of the Doe Fund, who have tossed their hat into the Republican, into the ring as Republicans for the slate. So once that happened, and particularly Loda, there's been a lot of traction around Loda's candidacy. I think that he was endorsed by all the members of the New York City Council, including Halloran, I believe. The Smith's talk has faded. The real question, though, is what the impact will be on the balance of power in the New York State Senate. Now, people and listeners might recall that Smith, who, as I said, was the leader of the mainstream Democratic conference in the Senate, is now part of that breakaway group, the Independent Democratic Conference.
Indeed.
Smith joined up with the IDC, as it's known, in, I think, November of last year, as the exact makeup of who was going to control the chamber was in flux. So the IDC had been getting a lot of criticism along racial lines. Its four original members, Jeff Klein of the Bronx, Diane Savino of Staten Island, David Valesky of the Syracuse area, and David Carlucci of Rockland County, are all white. And they essentially had aligned, there is now a formal alliance, but they had aligned with the Republican conference, which has 30 white senators, to keep the Republicans in control of this chamber, despite the fact that you had more Democrats elected in the 2012 elections than Republicans. And you had a quote-unquote, what we're calling now the mainstream Democratic conference, which is dominated by senators of color and which is led by a female senator of color, Andrea Stewart Cousins. So Smith really was, he was seen as kind of shielding the IDC from a lot of that racially based criticism.
So did that come out, do you think, and it's hard to assign motivation, of course, but do you think that came out of a desire of the machinations within the New York State Senate or the overriding desire to be mayor of New York City?
It's difficult to really divine his motivations. He, of course, says it's about bringing function and reform to the state Senate. That, which is, you know, it's going to be fun to replay those quotes in light of the recent news here. But the thing is,
but he was
that,
heading towards the Republicans, is Joe's point.
Yes,
I think
he was tacking toward the Republicans. Yes, and certainly his considerations and his nascent mayoral ambitions played into his decision. Smith also knew, and he saw firsthand, that, you know, there are benefits to defecting in the New York State Senate, right? If he had stayed a member of the mainstream Democratic conference, what's he going to get? He's just a guy. He joins up with the IDC. He finds himself in a nicer suite of offices. He was able to give his staffers raises. And in politics, the people who you put on your staff are often close political supporters, or they're people who are close to you in some other way. So that's very real. So Smith did this. I reported on it. I think it was earlier this year. He was able to give his staffers raises. He was able to hire more staffers. So there is a certain element of to the defector go the spoils. And Smith certainly benefited from that. There's also the question of influence. By joining the IDC, which is again allied now with the Republicans to control the state Senate, Smith was able to win for himself a certain more influence over policy. And one of the things that he tried to position himself on was the recovery efforts from Superstorm Sandy and being very involved with the state Senate task force that was formed after the storm. So I think for all those those reasons, and I think you make a really great point, Joe. I think that the nascent mayoral ambitions, especially at the time that he defected to the IDC, they certainly played a role, but there were more direct motivations as well.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back and follow up on this conversation, and then we'll take an NPR news break and come back and talk about some new subjects as well. You're listening to The Roundtable on The Roundtable. We will return after this short break. Welcome back to our roundtable. On the roundtable, we would love to hear from you and hear what's on your mind. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We're going to go to an NPR news break in just a few minutes. Before we do that, we'll wrap up on this conversation about Malcolm Smith and Dan Halloran and their arrest for allegedly trying to rig the New York City mayoral election. And Alan?
Very quickly, I just wanted to say that the higher you go, the more at risk you put yourself for your rivals to figure out if you've done something wrong and to leak it. And I suspect that may have happened here.
I'm nodding.
Yeah, so I mean, if there's a point where you say, look at me, look at me, look at me, then people are going to start to look at you, and yeah, they're going to watch every move.
You bring yourself in for more not criticism, but for a more watchful eye. You know, there are more people who are examining you at the congressional level, for example, than at a local council race.
Yeah. So real quick, in the 2 or 3 minutes that we have, what are we watching for today?
Well, I'm waiting to read this complaint against Senator Smith. I'm waiting to see what the exact allegations are, and I'm waiting to see the fallout in the, like I said, in that balance of power in the Senate. Will Malcolm be defended by the IDC people? Will he be, cast out? What will Governor Cuomo, who has given tacit support, essentially given a tacit blessing to this IDC GOP arrangement that is now running the Senate, what will he say?
He'll say, the law is the law.
Well, that is true.
That's what he's going to say. The law is the law.
Are there any other IDC prospects?
Yes.
Can we just use that on the comment during the news?
The law is the law.
Yeah, just have Alan do that. That'd be great for comment. Yeah, so any other?
Well, I'll be watching for that, prospects. And I'll be watching to see there's a push for campaign finance reform that's going to gain some traction this year. We're going to hear a lot about that before the end of the legislative session in June. I'm curious as to how this is going to play in, because it's yet again another lawmaker in trouble with the law. And there is talk that trying to, or rather the advocates of these kinds of campaign finance proposals say that if you get some of the money out of politics, it will essentially reduce the temptations here. And, I'm curious to see how that's going to play into this. This is going to play into
bribes.
The old Talmudic story that ends, maybe, maybe. but I got to tell you, I've written a column on that very subject today, available at thelegislativegazette.com.
LegislativeGazette.com. You can email us and weigh in on this topic, roundtable at WAMC.org. You can also comment on our webpage or Facebook page or tweet us at WAMC Roundtable. Jimmy Vielkind from the Times Union is here. WAMC's Alan Chartok, WAMC's news director Ian Pickus. We'll be back in just a moment after an NPR news break and take on lots of subjects, including the New York State budget and what's going on in North Korea and more. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Welcome back to The Roundtable on The Roundtable for this second day of April 2013. Alan Chartok is here. Ian Pickus is here or as we call him in the office, Ian Pickus, because that's how you pronounce his name.
Close enough.
And Jimmy Vielkind is here from the Times Union and their Capitol Bureau. And that's where your office is, right? Your desk is within the confines
that's
of the Capitol
right.
building.
Right on the third floor of the historic New York State Capitol.
And while I have a chance, let me just say, Jimmy Vielkind writes the best stuff. I mean, he really gets the information. He works hard. And what we read is just fabulous. He beats everybody.
Listeners can't see it, but I just slipped Alan $20.
Thanks a lot.
We'll see you at the FBI press conference. Yeah.
All right. So we have a budget in New York. Is it signed yet? We haven't signed it yet, have we?
Well, no, it's not signed yet.
It's supposed to be
ceremonially. It's been signed.
Ceremonially, the governor is going to be in Buffalo and Rochester today to sign the bills. fun fact, you don't actually need to sign the appropriations bills for the New York State budget. You have to sign the what are called Article 7 bills that kind of set spending policy. So we have a budget. The budget has taken effect. And, you know, it's over the course of the week since it was unveiled late over last weekend, not this Easter weekend, but the Palm Sunday weekend, we've started to see some of the details, and there are some interesting things in it. It was a budget that passed on time, causing lawmakers to cheer. There is an increase in the minimum wage embedded in the budget. It will rise to $9 an hour by December 31, 2015, and it'll rise to $8 an hour by the end of this calendar year. There are going to be $350 rebate checks that will be sent to families with a child between roughly age 2 and 18 and a half. That's going to come a few weeks before Election Day in 2014, which is a coincidence that I don't know if I've heard a really good explanation for it other than that
but
it's
that
just
But that is within the law. That's not bribery.
Oh, no. That's fine. And that's middle-class tax relief, the politicians have been quick to emphasize.
$350.
$350.
Because if you're in the middle class, you have to have children to get... Yeah. Right,
you have,
absolutely.
Fill up your gas tank twice.
As a father of a two-year-old, I can tell you that I think it's still an economic loser. So the budget has that. The budget decreased funding for disabled care services by $90 million from the state, which means it's a $180 million cut for these organizations that care for disabled people. And the state budget also increased school aid a little bit more than what Governor Cuomo had proposed, which was a little bit more than last year. So most school districts are going to see their numbers up, but they still say that they need more money. And I think that I'm going to be able to say that sentence basically every year for the rest of my life that I have to cover the New York state budget.
Sure.
Well, it's hard to believe, you know, that but
this business that,
that
Jimmy has just talked about, although there's... this business of cutting on the people who are the most defenseless, you know, the mentally ill, the people who have special needs, it really is awful. Of course, they can point to federal audits and things which say some of that money wasn't being well spent, but it's a terrible thing.
You've been following that issue for a long time. How has it changed as a political issue?
Never. I mean, my doctoral dissertation was on it. I have followed it all along. When they sit down and they need to make some money in the budget, they are almost always going to look at those people who have the least clout. And that's who we're talking about here, the mentally ill. At the same time, we're talking about, oh, boy, we can't have the mentally ill, getting guns and all the rest of it and scapegoating them. At the same time, well, then what should we do? We should have clinics that serve the mentally ill. We should do all of that. But we'll never do it because that costs money.
Yeah, and there's also a lot of criticism has come forward because people see this as a questioning of priorities. And a lot of lawmakers made the point that we're going to give over $400 million in tax breaks to film and television production in this budget, but we're cutting $90 million from the disabled.
Well, isn't that to get his show in New York?
Jimmy Fallon.
Well, yes, and there was budget language seems tailored to bring Jimmy Fallon, a St. Rose alum, I believe.
Yes.
Did he graduate?
He did not. Well, no,
a St. Rose attendee.
Yes.
If he's hired to take over The Tonight Show to come back to New York. There are lots of ifs, but the budget language is there. But the other point here is that in the other larger super context is that New York bills the federal government for half of the Medicaid costs, right? Medicaid is a state and federally funded program, with the counties also picking up some of the
costs.
In
New York it is.
In New York, yeah. Correct. And so essentially, New York has apparently been overbilling for the care for the disabled for several years now. This is something that I think was first exposed by the Poughkeepsie Journal. It's been picked up by federal auditors, by congressional investigators, where the federal authorities say that New York owes the feds $15 billion. So in order to kind of settle this, that's a lot in the context of a state budget that is $135 billion annually.
Even so they made a deal.
So they made a deal. And part of that deal was that New York has to cut what it's going to get from the feds, and therefore it needs to find more money for it in its own budget or cut what it spends. And so part of this, and what we heard from several legislators, is that members of the Senate and the Assembly wanted to restore these cuts. But Cuomo held firm, and part of it was because I think there is negotiating posture between the state and federal officials, where how can you claim, oh, you can't cut me by that much, I don't have the money, when boom, you've turned around and instantly restored the cuts. So there is more going on, and that's not something that the governor or his aides can really say directly, because how can you say that, recognizing that there's a human toll? But that's what I've heard, and that's the best explanation for this. And also the argument that they have been overbilling, that they've been living somewhat fat. Now, of course, if you talk to the care providers, they say that is absolutely not the case, that they have already weathered a cut 2 years ago, that they are at the bone, and that they will have trouble weathering this further cut. There's one lawmaker, Harvey Weisenberg, an assemblyman, a Democrat from Long Island.
Yeah, he was unhappy.
Whose son, Ricky, is developmentally disabled. Ricky is about 54 years old, I think, now. Right. And Weisenberg, on the floor of the assembly, recounted the litany of mistreatment that his son has suffered at the hands of state care, at the hands of private care. And he kept saying, he had this refrain in his speech, he kept, inadequate staff, staff cuts, inadequate training, always the reason, always the reason. He's just describing
Jimmy,
how his son was scalded.
Yeah, but Jimmy and group, isn't it amazing how a legislator who has a senator, a United States senator who has a gay son, or somebody who has a developmentally disabled son, can make a huge difference based on their personal experience as opposed to sitting there with a bunch of budget numbers?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that that's one of the, you know, people talk about how rank and file lawmakers have no power, right? Or have no voice in the process. Or I think this is one of the great things about a legislature, and this is, you have people of varying experiences who bring different things to the table, right? Mr. Weisenberg is a former high school teacher or principal. I don't recall which. He's a lifeguard, which is kind of cool. Even in his advanced age, I believe he's certainly over 60, might be over 70. And yes, he has a developmentally disabled son. And so he passionately cares about these issues. We have a local representative in the Capital Region, John McDonald, who is a licensed pharmacist and runs a pharmacy. Right. He brings that perspective to the table. We have farmers. We have business people. We have attorneys. So,
but I would disagree with you on one thing here. I think, Jimmy, that, you know, when Shelley Silver says, okay, boys, this is what we're going to do. For the most part, this is what we're going to do.
Oh, I don't dispute that. I don't dispute that. And I think that a lot of these legislators recognize that you have to swallow for the greater good.
That's an interesting term, the greater good.
Well, the greater good, but this, you know, they recognize how the system works. These budgets are negotiated documents, and there are lots of things that they like. The term of art that my colleague Casey Seiler so wonderfully recounted is kumquat. You know, there was a state senator from Westchester County who stood up on the floor and said, you know, you get the holiday gift basket, you drink the bottle of wine, you eat the peanut brittle, but then you look at the kumquats and you chuck them in the garbage. So what do? You accept the basket, or do you call Aunt Millie and say, nope, I'm not taking it, I don't like the kumquats.
Yeah.
So, you know, this cut to the developmentally disabled was described by many legislators as their kumquat in this budget thing. But again, it's in a large spending bill. And
I want to say one thing, and that is, I've been saying it all along, because Andrew Cuomo is in such a preeminent position. Basically, he's got the state assembly, which are progressive Democrats. He goes to the Senate, and now he's got this thing where these independent, so-called independent Democrats, some of them are called traitors, are there. If Andrew Cuomo pulls that rug out from under the Republicans, they're done. They're done in New York. He can pull the other guys in, the independent caucus in, and he can say, you get back there where you belong with the Democrats. He hasn't done that because he wants the Republicans to slow things down. So, Jimmy, here's my point. There's not three men in a room anymore. It's really one man in the room.
Well, yes and no. I mean, the governor does have quite a position of power. As you point out, he has a bully pulpit. And I think that the Senate Republicans, particularly in this election cycle, were very cognizant that if Andrew Cuomo directly engaged them, they would have had a real hard time holding on to these seats. Now, by and large, the governor did not directly engage
them. No, he wants them. He wants the Republicans.
He has not said that.
Oh, come on. No, I'm saying it. He wants the Republicans.
Alan Chartok has said clearly that.
And if he didn't, want the Republicans, then he would have done what he said he was going to do in the campaign. He would have vetoed that self-serving bill and allowing them to draw their own districts. He swore he was going to do it during the campaign. He didn't do it. And ipso facto, magnifico, he wanted the Republicans.
I think, though, that I would push back a little bit on what you said about there being one man in the room. You know, legislators, and the older legislators really get this. The older legislators really get that. You know, however big or bad or good a governor may be, they are not accountable to the same constituents. They're accountable to their locals.
You think those guys want to go to the minority party, be the minority? They do not. And Cuomo has the power to put them back in the minority. That's my feeling about this. In the old days, when Warren Anderson didn't want to bring a bill up, he didn't bring a bill up. That's all there was to it, or Joe Bruno.
But Alan, as we both know, you know, power and relative power are fickle. They are ever-changing in New York. And so what have we seen? We've seen over the past few months, we've seen the governor's poll standing start to come back to earth.
Yes.
As one observer said, it's now hovering in the stratosphere, but it is within the earth's atmosphere again. And we've seen legislators start to be emboldened. If you watch and you wait for things to play out, if the governor continues to have trouble gaining traction, there have been a lot of negative reviews of this budget by business groups, by some labor groups, editorial boards around this state. You know, perhaps we could see Governor Cuomo at a 60% job approval rating having different relations than Governor Cuomo at a 70% approval rating.
Yeah, but you still don't have that situation. I mean, I know it's going around a second time, but you still don't have that situation where the Republicans basically have less people in their house than the Democrats do, if you add it all up. And if Cuomo wanted something else, I'll tell you one thing, Jimmy. If you take a look at something like campaign financing, which you mentioned, he can have that bill if he wants it. He can have that bill if he wants it. You go to Dean Skelos and say, Skelos, either you give me that bill or you're done.
Yeah, but at the same point, you could argue that it behooves the governor to have a Democrat-dominated assembly, which will probably be Democrat-dominated until I'm buried in the ground.
Forever.
And a Senate controlled by Republicans, because it allows Cuomo to play the part of Solomonic centrist when he wants to.
Exactly.
And it also allows him to balance competing interests off of each other.
No, he wants them. Ipso facto, he wants the Republicans. I mean, it's what I said. It's what I meant. It's what you're saying now.
And Alan Chartok says he wants the Republicans.
He wants the Republicans. What, you don't believe he wants the Republicans? Hey, Jimmy, do you believe he wants the Republicans?
Hey,
or you're not allowed to say?
This is good water in my coffee mug here, you know?
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we will be back in mere seconds. As quick as you can say, ipso facto, magnifico, we will be back. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Welcome back to The Roundtable. On The Roundtable, we just have a few minutes left, and we have a wonderful panel before us. Alan is here. Jimmy Vielkind of the Times Union is here, and Ian Pickus is here as well. We welcome your input, roundtable at WAMC.org. And I think we should probably end with the top story of the morning, and that is North Korea and the U.S. continuing to monitor this situation as the world monitors this situation. And I mean, I think it's safe to say, and this is probably, you know, the ultimate understatement, but it's troubling. Right? I mean, this is all very troubling. So, but it's been going on for a long time. It's been troubling. And I mean, diplomatically, what do we do in a situation like this?
Well, I think, first of all, you try everything you can. But first of all, you have to know what's really happening. Is this kid, relative kid, in charge? Or is it the military that's in charge? So who's pulling the strings? We do know that the key here is China. China, which you'll remember a small affair called the Korean War, was an ally of Korea, and that's why you got the armistice. There's never been a peace, but the armistice that we have with the Koreans. Now, the Chinese obviously don't like what's happening here. and have a tremendous amount of moral suasion. Can really play the key place. The question is, sometimes you get leaders who are nuts. I mean, crazy. Hitler was crazy and did things that were just nuts. So the question here is, how crazy are they? How crazy would an Ayatollah be who, you know, who would send people to die and blow themselves up? Would a society want to blow itself up? I don't say that they're the same, the Ayatollah and the Koreans, but we really know that they have done some very counterproductive things for themselves.
Or is this just a young leader who's trying to prove to the people who are watching him at home that he's a tough guy and at the same time posturing to maybe get greater aid packages when he stands
sure.
down?
We can
and
only,
I have no idea.
We can only hope that
yeah,
that's what
right.
it is.
Right.
Yeah.
So now we have the military drills going on. We have the U.S. and South Korea working together as
the stealth bombers,
the exercises, right? The stealth bombers, and we're bringing in the USS John McCain, and which I'll be honest, I missed that was.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah, I didn't. I when I read that, I was like, oh, well. I mean, it makes sense. I was surprised. So, you know, how close are we to another situation? And I guess that's the million-dollar question.
Well, I think that there are elements within our defense establishment who are determined to shut down the North Koreans no matter what. Now, look, you go back to General of the Army MacArthur and how he wanted to bomb the Chinese and all the rest of it. You have the potential here for factions within our government to be saying, we have to get them before they get us. And you just saw the South Koreans saying, we are going to have a defense posture in which if we think that they're going to do something, we're going to get them first.
Right.
And meanwhile,
analysts have been very skeptical that the North Koreans are able to follow through on much of what they have what they have said.
Are these the same analysts who had not a clue that the wall was coming down in Berlin, that communism was over as we know it? I don't put a lot of stock in the so-called analysts.
Meaning, in the sense of, I mean, you can say, look, I have, we're going to make this threat, we're going to make this nuclear threat, North Korea is going to make this nuclear threat against South Korea and against the United States, and obviously you have to take that very seriously. But then there are those who say, okay, but we look at what they possess, and we don't know that they have the military power to follow
through. We know they have atomic bombs. We know that. Because they've set them off and we can see that. We also know that the South Korean stock market is going up. Go figure that one.
Yeah. So and then in the meantime, we just this has been a very long. I mean, obviously we're taking action, but there's a very long waiting game in this, isn't there?
You know. I mean, the real question is the South Korean president said, look, if they pull anything, there won't be a North Korea.
Right, right.
There won't be a North Korea. You got the stealth bombers showing that they can fly from the United States and deliver right to North Korea. They don't have to come from any other place. It can really, I think there is a potential for something very bad happening here, really bad.
Well, we'll pray that's not the case, and obviously be watching, and as the world will be watching the story as it unfolds. We have just a few moments left. We should note that yesterday was opening day in
Indeed.
Baseball. Mm-hmm. Officially, it was Sunday night was the first game, but yesterday was the opening day, especially in New York, where we had two opening days, both for the Mets and the Yankees, which is the first time since
1956.
1956.
Mets are undefeated.
Yes,
Mets are in first place.
And the Yankees are old.
Mets are undefeated. Yankees had a bad day. And you know.
How are the Phillies, your team?
I believe the – I don't think Did the Phillies play yesterday?
Good question.
I don't think.
I wanted to point out the Phillies are your team.
The Phillies are my team. Yeah. Very much my team. You know, here's why I don't think anything went on, because I have my alert on my phone and nothing beeped.
Okay.
Now, okay. It's possible that in the new phone I did not, but we have to check that. Thank you, Alan. I'll get on that. I know you had an ulterior motive there, but that still.
Who, me, have an ulterior motive?
Yeah, I know.
I'm hoping that this year, I every year I vow to myself that I'm going to follow baseball, and then I'm really going to get read the papers and follow the ups and downs, and maybe this will be the year. You know, maybe this will be the year. But it seems that opening day for baseball to me is just the beginning of me breaking my annual vow to actually be a baseball fan.
You got to get yourself in a fantasy league. That'll make you pay attention.
Yeah, because I have so much time.
Right.
You know, and,
well, yeah, but you make time for the things that yes, that's the rub.
I know.
The great thing about the Mets is that either they're the worst team in organized baseball, or the next year they win the pennant, and this could be the year.
It could be.
You never know.
They're 1-0.
Yeah, I mean,
although
they
took a big blow with Johan Santana going out for the year. That's not helpful.
Who knew about the Nationals?
That's terrible. But what about Euclides? What about
Euclides?
Euclides?
Yeah.
Euclides?
What about him?
the great Greek philosopher Euclides.
Yeah, what about him? You know, he got a terrific reception at Yankee Stadium.
Which is a surprise. I think it's going to get take some getting used to. This enemy from the Northeast of the last 9 years now being maybe the linchpin in how the Yankees tread water until some of their stars come back. I mean, he was batting fourth yesterday. I don't like it myself. But
why don't
you
like it?
You know, you hated him for so long.
I never hated him.
As a Yankee fan.
I always thought, I particularly loved him.
Oh, I wonder why. I know why.
And on that note, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to conclude this roundtable on the roundtable. We have plenty of show coming up, but we are going to end this conversation. We welcome you to email us, roundtable@wamc.org. You can also comment on our webpage or Facebook page or tweet us at WAMC Roundtable. Alan Chartok, Ian Pickus, Jimmy Vielkind, thank you very much for being here. I appreciate
Fun.
It.
Thanks, Joe. We'll do Koufax, Greenberg, and Sean Green sometime tomorrow.
Steel cage match.
Yeah, you've gone and said it.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.